9. She never even had a nickel to herself anymore. They were that poor. Money was the main thing. All the time it was money, money, money. They had to pay through the nose for Baby Wilson's private room and private nurse. But even that was just one bill. By the time one thing was paid for, something else always would crop up. They owed around $200 that had to be paid right away. They lost the house. Their dad got $100 out of the deal and let the bank take over the mortgage. Then he borrowed another $50 and Mr. Singer went on the note with them. Afterward, they had to worry about rent every month instead of taxes. They were mighty near as poor as factory folks, only nobody could look down on them. Bill had a job in a bottling plant and made $10 a week. Hazel worked as a helper in a beauty parlor for $8. Etta sold tickets at a movie for $5. Each of them paid half of what they earned for their keep. Then the house had 6 boarders at $5 a head, and Mr. Singer, who paid his rent very prompt. With what their dad picked up, it all came to about $200 a month, and out of that, they had to feed the 6 boarders pretty good, and feed the family, and pay rent for the whole house, and keep up the payments on the furniture. George and her didn't get any lunch money now. She had to stop the music lessons. Portia saved the leftovers from the dinner for her and George to eat after school. All the time, they had their meals in the kitchen. Whether Bill and Hazel and Etta sat with the boarders or ate in the kitchen depended on how much food there was. In the kitchen, they had grits and grease and side meat and coffee for breakfast. For supper, they had the same thing along with whatever could be spared from the dining room. The big kids griped whenever they had to eat in the kitchen, and sometimes she and George were downright hungry for 2 or 3 days. But this was in the outside room. It had nothing to do with music and foreign countries and the plans she made. The winter was cold. Frost was on the window panes. At night, the fire in the living room crackled very warm. All the family sat by the fire with the boarders, so she had the middle bedroom to herself. She wore 2 sweaters and a pair of Bill's outgrown corduroy pants. Excitement kept her warm. She would bring out her private box from under the bed and sit on the floor to work. In the big box, there were the pictures she had painted at the government free art class. She had taken them out of Bill's room. Also in the box, she kept 3 mystery books her dad had given her, a compact, a box of watch parts, a rhinestone necklace, a hammer, and some notebooks. One notebook was marked on the top with red crayon. Private, keep out. Private, and tied with a string. She had worked on music in this notebook all the winter. She quit studying school lessons at night so she could have more time to spend on music. Mostly, she had written just little tunes, songs, without any words and without even any bass notes to them. They were very short. But even if the tunes were only half a page long, she gave them names and drew her initials underneath them. Nothing in this book was a real piece or a composition. They were just songs in her mind she wanted to remember. She named them how they reminded her. Africa and a big fight and the snowstorm. She couldn't write the music just like it sounded in her mind. She had to thin it down to only a few notes, otherwise she got too mixed up to go further. There was so much she didn't know about how to write music. But maybe after she learned how to write these simple tunes fairly quick, she could begin to put down the whole music in her mind. In January, she began a certain very wonderful piece called This Thing I Want, I Know Not What. It was a beautiful and marvelous song, very slow and soft. At first, she had started to write a poem along with it, but she couldn't think of ideas to fit the music. Also, it was hard to get a word for the third line to rhyme with what. This new song made her feel sad and excited and happy all at once. Music beautiful as this was hard to work on. Any song was hard to write. Something she could hum in 2 minutes meant a whole week's work before it was down in the notebook. After she had figured up the scale and the time and every note. She had to concentrate hard and sing it many times. Her voice was always hoarse. Her dad said this was because she had bawled so much when she was a baby. Her dad would have to get up and walk with her every night when she was Ralph's age. The only thing would hush her, he always said, was for him to beat the coal scuttle with a poke and sing Dixie. She lay on her stomach on the cold floor and thought. Later on, when she was 20, she would be a great world-famous composer. She would have a whole symphony orchestra and conduct all of her music herself. She would stand up on the platform in front of the big crowds of people. To conduct the orchestra, she would wear either a real man's evening suit or else a red dress spangled with rhinestones. The curtains of the stage would be red velvet, and M.K. would be printed on them in gold. Mr. Singer would be there, and afterward they would go out and eat fried chicken. He would admire her and count her as his very best friend. George would bring up big wreaths of flowers to the stage. It would be in New York City, or else in a foreign country. Famous people would point at her, Carol Lombard and Arturo Toscanini and Admiral Byrd, and she could play the Beethoven Symphony any time she wanted to. It was a queer thing about this music she had heard last autumn. The symphony stayed inside her always and grew, little by little. The reason was this. The whole symphony was in her mind. It had to be. She had heard every note. And somewhere in the back of her mind, the whole of the music was still there, just as it had been played. But she could do nothing to bring it all out again, except wait and be ready for the times when suddenly a new part came to her. Wait for it to grow like leaves grow slowly on the branches of a spring oak tree. In the inside room, along with the music, there was Mr. Singer. Every afternoon, as soon as she finished playing on the piano in the gym, she walked down the main street past the store where he worked. From the front window, she couldn't see Mr. Singer. He worked in the back behind a curtain. But she looked at the store, where he stayed every day, and saw the people he knew. Then every night, she waited on the front porch for him to come home. Sometimes she followed him upstairs. She sat on the bed and watched him put away his hat and undo the button on his collar and brush his hair. For some reason, it was like they had a secret together, or like they waited to tell each other things that had never been said before. He was the only person in the inside room. A long time ago, there had been others. She thought back and remembered how it was before he came. She remembered a girl, way back in the sixth grade, named Celeste. This girl had straight blonde hair and a turned-up nose and freckles. She wore a red wool jumper with a white blouse. She walked pigeon-toed. Every day, she brought an orange for little recess and a blue tin box of lunch for big recess. Other kids would gobble the food they had brought at little recess and then were hungry later, but not Celeste. She pulled off the crusts of her sandwiches and ate only the soft middle part. Always she had a stuffed hard-boiled egg, and she would hold it in her hand, mashing the yellow with her thumb so that the print of her finger was left there. Celeste never talked to her, and she never talked to Celeste, although that was what she wanted more than anything else. At night, she would lie awake and think about Celeste. She would plan that they were best friends, and think about the time when Celeste could come home with her to eat supper and spend the night. But that never happened. The way she felt about Celeste would never let her go up and make friends with her, like she would any other person. After a year, Celeste moved to another part of town and went to another school. Then there was a boy called Buck. He was big and had pimples on his face. When she stood by him in line to march in at 8:30, he smelled bad, like his britches needed airing. Buck did a nosedive at the principal once and was suspended. When he laughed, he lifted his upper lip and shook all over. She thought about him like she had thought about Celeste. Then there was the lady who sold lottery tickets for a turkey raffle, and Miss Anglin, who taught the seventh grade, and Carol Lombard in the movies. All of them. But with Mr. Singer, there was a difference. The way she felt about him came on her slowly, and she could not think back and realize just how it happened. The other people had been ordinary, but Mr. Singer was not. The first day he rang the doorbell to ask about a room, she had looked a long time into his face. She had opened the door and read over the card he handed her. Then she called her mama and went back in the kitchen to tell Portia and Bubba about him. She followed him and her mama up the stairs and watched him poke the mattress on the bed and roll up the shades to see if they worked. The day he moved, she sat on the front porch banisters and watched him get out of the 10-cent taxi with his suitcase and his chessboard. Then later she listened to him thump around in his room and imagined about him. The rest came in a gradual way, so that now there was this secret feeling between them. She talked to him more than she had ever talked to a person before. And if he could have talked, he would have told her many things. It was like he was some kind of great teacher. Only because he was a mute, he did not teach. In the bed at night, she planned about how she was an orphan and lived with Mr. Singer, just the two of them, in a foreign house where in the winter it would snow. Maybe in a little Switzerland town with the high glaciers and the mountains all around, where rocks were on top of all the houses and the roofs were steep and pointed. Or in France, where the people carried home bread from the store without its being wrapped. Or in the foreign country of Norway by the gray winter ocean. In the morning, the first thing she would think of was him, along with music. When she put on her dress, she wondered where she would see him that day. She used some of Etta's perfume or a drop of vanilla so that if she met him in the hall, she would smell good. She went to school late so she could see him come down the stairs on his way to work. And in the afternoon and night, she never left the house if he was there. Each new thing she learned about him was important. He kept his toothbrush and toothpaste in a glass on his table. So instead of leaving her toothbrush on the bathroom shelf, she kept it in a glass also. He didn't like cabbage. Harry, who worked for Mr. Brannan, mentioned that to her. Now she couldn't eat cabbage either. When she learned new facts about him, or when she said something to him and he wrote a few words with his silver pencil, she had to be off by herself for a long time to think it over. When she was with him, the main thought in her mind was to store up everything so that later she could live it over and remember. But the inside room with music and Mr. Singer was not all. Many things happened in the outside room. She fell down the stairs and broke off one of her front teeth. Miss Minner gave her two bad cards in English. She lost a quarter in a vacant lot, and although she and George hunted for 3 days, they never found it. This happened. One afternoon, she was studying for an English test out on the back steps. Harry began to chop wood over on his side of the fence, and she hollered to him. He came and diagrammed a few sentences for her. His eyes were quick behind his horn-rimmed glasses. After he explained the English to her, he stood up and jerked his hands in and out of the pockets of his lumberjack. Harry was always full of energy, nervous, and he had to be talking or doing something every minute. "You see, there's just two things nowadays," he said. He liked to surprise people, and sometimes she didn't know how to answer him. "It's the truth. There's just two things ahead nowadays." "What?" "Militant democracy or fascism." "Don't you like Republicans?" "Shucks," Harry said. "That's not what I mean." He had explained all about the fascists one afternoon. He told how the Nazis made little Jew children get down on their hands and knees and eat grass from the ground. He told about how he planned to assassinate Hitler. He had it all worked out thoroughly. He told about how there wasn't any justice or freedom in fascism. He said the newspapers wrote deliberate lies, and people didn't know what was going on in the world. The Nazis were terrible. Everybody knew that. She plotted with him to kill Hitler. It would be better to have 4 or 5 people in the conspiracy so that if one missed him, the others could bump him off just the same. And even if they died, they would all be heroes. To be a hero was almost like being a great musician. Either one or the other. And although I don't believe in war, I'm ready to fight for what I know is right. Me too, she said. I'd like to fight the fascists. I could dress up like a boy and nobody could ever tell. Cut my hair off and all. It was a bright winter afternoon. The sky was blue-green, and the branches of the oak trees in the backyard were black and bare against this color. The sun was warm. The day made her feel full of energy. Music was in her mind. Just to be doing something, she picked up a 10-penny nail and drove it into the steps with a few good wallops. Their dad heard the sound of the hammer and came out in his bathrobe to stand around a while. Under the tree, there were two carpenter's horses, and little Ralph was busy putting a rock on top of one and then carrying it over to the other one, back and forth. He walked with his hands out to balance himself. He was bow-legged, and his diapers dragged down to his knees. George was shooting marbles. Because he needed a haircut, his face looked thin. Some of his permanent teeth had already come, but they were small and blue like he'd been eating blackberries. He drew a line for Taw and lay on his stomach to take aim for the first hole. When their dad went back to his watchwork, he carried Ralph with him, and after a while, George went off into the alley by himself. Since he shot Baby, he wouldn't buddy with a single person. I gotta go, Harry said. I gotta be at work before 6. You like it at the cafe? Do you get good things to eat free? Sure, and all kinds of folks come in the place. I like it better than any job I ever had. Pays more. I hate Mr. Brannan, Mick said. It was true that even though he never said anything mean to her, he always spoke in a rough, funny way. He must have known all along about the pack of chewing gum she and George swiped that time. And then why would he ask her how her business was coming along, like he did up in Mr. Singer's room? Maybe he thought they took things regular. And they didn't. They certainly did not. Only once, a little watercolor set from the 10-cent store and a nickel pencil sharpener. I can't stand Mr. Brannan. He's all right, Harry said. Sometimes he seems a right queer kind of person, but he's not crabby when you get to know him. One thing I've thought about, Mick said. A boy has a better advantage like that than a girl. I mean, a boy can usually get some part-time job that don't take him out of school and leaves him time for other things. But there's not jobs like that for girls. When a girl wants a job, she has to quit school and work full-time. I'd sure like to earn a couple of bucks a week like you do, but there's just not any way. Harry sat on the steps and untied his shoestrings. He pulled at them until one broke. A man comes to the cafe named Mr. Blunt, Mr. Jake Blunt. I like to listen to him. I learn a lot from the things he says when he drinks beer. He's given me some new ideas. I know him good. He comes here every Sunday. Harry unlaced his shoe and pulled the broken string to even length so he could tie it in a bow again. Listen, he rubbed his glasses on his lumberjack in a nervous way. You needn't mention to him what I said. I mean, I doubt if he would remember me. He don't talk to me. He just talks to Mr. Singer. He might think it was funny if you know what I mean. Okay. She read between the words that he had a crush on Mr. Blunt, and she knew how he felt. I wouldn't mention it. Dark came on. The moon, white like milk, showed in the blue sky, and the air was cold. She could hear Ralph and George and Portia in the kitchen. The fire in the stove made the kitchen window a warm orange. There was the smell of smoke and supper. You know, this is something I never have told anybody, he said. I hate to realize it about myself.
What?
You remember when you first began to read the newspapers and think about the things you read?
Sure.
I used to be a fascist. I used to think I was. It was this way. You know all the pictures of the people our age in Europe marching and singing songs and keeping step together? I used to think that was wonderful. All of them pledged to each other and with one leader. All of them with the same ideals and marching and step together. I didn't worry much about what was happening to the Jewish minorities because I didn't want to think about it. And because at the time I didn't want to think like I was Jewish. You see, I didn't know. I just looked at the pictures and read what it said underneath and didn't understand. I never knew what an awful thing it was. I thought I was a fascist. Of course, later on, I found out different. His voice was bitter against himself and kept changing from a man's voice to a young boy's.
Well, you didn't realize then, she said. It was a terrible transgression, a moral wrong.
That was the way he was. Everything was either very right or very wrong, with no middle way. It was wrong for anyone under 20 to touch beer or wine or smoke a cigarette. It was a terrible sin for a person to cheat on a test, but not a sin to copy homework. It was a moral wrong for girls to wear lipstick or sun-backed dresses. It was a terrible sin to buy anything with a German or Japanese label, no matter if it cost only a nickel.
She remembered Harry back to the time when they were kids. Once his eyes got crossed and stayed crossed for a year, he would sit out on his front steps with his hands between his knees and watch everything, very quiet and cross-eyed. He skipped 2 grades in grammar school, and when he was 11, he was ready for vocational. But at vocational, when they read about the Jew in Ivanhoe, the other kids would look around at Harry and he would come home and cry. So his mother took him out of school. He stayed out for a whole year. He grew taller and very fat. Every time she climbed the fence, she would see him making himself something to eat in his kitchen. They both played around on the block, and sometimes they would wrestle. When she was a kid, she liked to fight with boys, real fights, but just in play. She used a combination jiu-jitsu and boxing. Sometimes he got her down, and sometimes she got him. Harry was never very rough with anybody. When little kids ever broke any toy, they would come to him, and he always took the time to fix it. He could fix anything. The ladies on the block got him to fix their electric lights or sewing machines when something went wrong. Then, when he was 13, he started back at vocational and began to study hard. He threw papers and worked on Saturdays and read. For a long time, she didn't see much of him until after that party she gave. He was very changed. Like this, Harry said. It used to be I had some big ambition for myself all the time, a great engineer or a great doctor or a lawyer, but now I don't have it that way. All I can think about is what happens in the world now, about fascism and the terrible things in Europe, and on the other hand, democracy. I mean, I can't think and work on what I mean to be in life because I think too much about this other. I dream about killing Hitler every night. And I wake up in the dark, very thirsty and scared of something. I don't know what. She looked at Harry's face, and a deep, serious feeling made her sad. His hair hung over his forehead. His upper lip was thin and tight, but the lower one was thick, and it trembled. Harry didn't look old enough to be 15. With the darkness, a cold wind came. The wind sang up in the oak trees on the block and banged the blinds against the side of the house. Down the street, Mrs. Wells was calling Sucker home. The dark late afternoon made the sadness heavy inside her. I want a piano. I want to take music lessons, she said to herself. She looked at Harry, and he was lacing his thin fingers together in different shapes. There was a warm boy smell about him. What was it made her act like she suddenly did? Maybe it was remembering the times when they were younger. Maybe it was because the sadness made her feel queer. But anyway, all of a sudden, she gave Harry a push that nearly knocked him off the steps. S.O.B. to your grandmother, she hollered to him. Then she ran. That was what kids used to say in the neighborhood when they picked a fight. Harry stood up and looked surprised. He settled his glasses on his nose and watched her for a second. Then he ran back to the alley. The cold air made her strong as Samson. When she laughed, there was a short, quick echo. She butted Harry with her shoulder, and he got a hold on her. They wrestled hard and laughed. She was the tallest, but his hands were strong. He didn't fight good enough, and she got him on the ground. Then suddenly he stopped moving, and she stopped too. His breathing was warm on her neck. And he was very still. She felt his ribs against her knees and his hard breathing as she sat on him. They got up together. They did not laugh anymore, and the alley was very quiet. As they walked across the dark backyard, for some reason, she felt funny. There was nothing to feel queer about, but suddenly it had just happened. She gave him a little push and he pushed her back. Then she laughed again and felt all right. "So long," Harry said. He was too old to climb the fence, so he ran through the side alley to the front of his house.
"Gosh, it's hot," she said. "I could smother in here."
Portia was warming her supper in the stove. Ralph banged a spoon on his high chair tray. George's dirty little hand pushed up his grits with a piece of bread, and his eyes were squinted in a faraway look. She helped herself to white meat and gravy and grits and a few raisins and mixed them up together on her plate. She ate 3 bites of them. She ate until all the grits were gone, but still she wasn't full. She had thought about Mr. Singer all the day, and as soon as supper was over, she went upstairs. But when she reached the 3rd floor, she saw that his door was open and his room dark. This gave her an empty feeling. Downstairs, she couldn't sit still and study for the English test. It was like she was so strong she couldn't sit on a chair in a room the same as other people. It was like she could knock down all the walls of the house and then march through the streets big as a giant. Finally, she got out her private box from under the bed. She lay on her stomach and looked over the notebook. There were about 20 songs now, but she didn't feel satisfied with them. If she could write a symphony for a whole orchestra, how did you write that? Sometimes several instruments played one note, so the staff would have to be very large. She drew 5 lines across a big sheet of test paper, the lines about an inch apart. When a note was for a violin, or cello, or flute, she would write the name of the instrument to show, and when they all played the same note together, she would draw a circle around them. At the top of the page, she wrote Symphony in large letters, and under that, Mick Kelly. Then she couldn't go any further. If she could only have music lessons. If only she could have a real piano. A long time passed before she could get started. The tunes were in her mind, but she couldn't figure out how to write them. It looked like this was the hardest play in the world. But she kept on figuring until Etta and Hazel came into the room and got into bed and said she had to turn the light off because it was 11 o'clock. 10. For 6 weeks, Portia had waited to hear from William. Every evening, she would come to the house and ask Dr. Copeland the same question. "You seen anybody who gotten a letter from Willie yet?" And every night, he was obliged to tell her that he had heard nothing. At last, she asked the question no more. She would come into the hall and look at him without a word. She drank. Her blouse was often half unbuttoned and her shoestrings loose. February came. The weather turned milder, then hot. The sun glared down with hard brilliance. Birds sang in the bare trees, and children played out of doors barefoot and naked to the waist. The nights were torrid as in midsummer. Then after a few days, winter was upon the town again. The mild skies darkened, a chill rain fell, and the air turned dank and bitterly cold. In the town, the Negroes suffered badly. Supplies of fuel had been exhausted, and there was a struggle everywhere for warmth. An epidemic of pneumonia raged through the wet, narrow streets, and for a week, Dr. Copeland slept at odd hours, fully clothed. Still, no word came from William. Portia had written 4 times, and Dr. Copeland 2. During most of the day and night, he had no time to think, but occasionally he found a chance to rest for a moment at home. He would drink a pot of coffee by the kitchen stove, and a deep uneasiness would come in him. 5 of his patients had died, and one of these was Augustus Benedict Matty Lewis, the little deaf-mute. He had been asked to speak at the burial service, but as it was his rule not to attend funerals, he was unable to accept this invitation. The 5 patients had not been lost because of any negligence on his part. The blame was in the long years of want which lay behind. The diets of cornbread and sow belly and syrup. The crowding of 4 and 5 persons to a single room. The death of poverty. He brooded on this and drank coffee to stay awake. Often he held his hand to his chin, for recently a slight tremor in the nerves of his neck made his head nod unsteadily when he was tired. Then during the fourth week of February, Portia came to the house. It was only 6 o'clock in the morning, and he was sitting by the fire in the kitchen, warming a pan of milk for breakfast. She was badly intoxicated. He smelled the keen, Swedish odor of gin, and his nostrils widened with disgust. He did not look at her, but busied himself with his breakfast. He crumpled some bread in a bowl and poured it over hot milk. He prepared coffee and laid the table. Then, when he was seated before his breakfast, he looked at Portia sternly.
Have you had your morning meal?
I'm not going to eat breakfast, she said.
You will need it, if you intend to get to work today.
I'm not going to work.
A dread came in him. He did not wish to question her further. He kept his eyes on his bowl of milk and drank from a spoon that was unsteady in his hand. When he had finished, he looked up at the wall above her head.
Are you tongue-tied?
I'm going to tell you. You're going to hear about it. Just as soon as I'm able to say it, I'm going to tell you.
Portia sat motionless in the chair, her eyes moving slowly from one corner of the wall to the other. Her arms hung down limp, and her legs were twisted loosely about each other. When he turned from her, he had, for a moment, a perilous sense of ease and freedom, which was more acute because he knew that soon it was to be shattered. He mended the fire and warmed his hands. Then he rolled a cigarette. The kitchen was in a state of spotless order and cleanliness. The saucepans on the wall glowed with the light of the stove, and behind each one there was a round, black shadow.
It about Willie.
I know.
He rolled the cigarette gingerly between his palms. His eyes glanced recklessly about him, greedy for the last sweet pleasures.
Once I mentioned to you this here Buster Johnson were at the prison with Willie. Us knowed him before. He was sent home yesterday.
So?
Buster been crippled for life.
His head quavered. He pressed his hand to his chin to steady himself, but the obstinate trembling was difficult to control.
Last night, these here friends come round to my house and say that Buster were home and had something to tell me about Willie. I ran all the way, and this here's what he said.
Yes.
There were three of them, Willie and Buster and this other boy. They were friends. Then this here trouble come up.
Portia halted. She wet her finger with her tongue and then moistened her dry lips with her finger.
It was something to do with the way this here white guard picked on them all the time. They were out on road work one day, and Buster, he sassed back, and then the other boy, he tried to run off in the woods. They'd taken all three of them. They'd taken all three of them up to the camp and put them in this here ice-cold room.
He said yes again, but his head quavered and the words sounded like a rattle in his throat.
It were about 6 weeks ago, Portia said. You remember that cold spell then? They put Willie and them boys in this room like ice.
Portia spoke in a low voice, and she neither paused between words nor did the grief in her face soften. It was like a low song. She spoke, and he could not understand. The sounds were distinct in his ear, but they had no shape or meaning. It was as though his head were the prow of a boat, and the sounds were water that broke on him and then flowed past. He felt he had to look behind to find the words already said.
And their feet swelled up, and they lay there and struggle on the floor and holler out, and nobody come. They hollered there for 3 days and 3 nights, and nobody come.
I am deaf, said Dr. Copeland. I cannot understand.
They put our Willie and them boys in this here ice-cold room. There were a rope hanging down from the ceiling. They taken their shoes off and they tied their bare feet to this rope. Willie and them boys lay there with their backs on the floor and their feet in the air.
and their feet swolled up, and they struggle on the floor and holler out. It were ice cold in the room, and their feet froze. Their feet swolled up, and they holler for 3 nights and 3 days, and nobody come.
Dr. Copeland pressed his head with his hands, but still the steady trembling would not stop.
I cannot hear what you say. Then at last they come to get them. They quickly taken Willie and them boys to the sick ward, and their legs were all swolled and froze. Gangrene. They sawed off both our Willie's feet. Buster Johnson lost 1 foot and the other boy got well, but our Willie, he crippled for life now. Both his feet sawed off.
The words were finished, and Portia leaned over and struck her head upon the table. She did not cry or moan, but she struck her head again and again on the hard-scrubbed top of the table. The bowl and spoon rattled, and he removed them to the sink. The words were scattered in his mind, but he did not try to assemble them. He scalded the bowl and spoon and washed out the dish towel. He picked up something from the floor and put it somewhere.
Crippled?
He asked.
William?
Portia knocked her head on the table, and the blows had a rhythm like the slow beat of a drum, and his heart took up this rhythm also. Quietly, the words came alive and fitted to the meaning, and he understood.
When will they send him home?
Portia leaned her drooping head on her arm.
Buster don't know that. Soon afterward, they separate all three of them in different places. They sent Buster to another camp. Since Willie only has a few more months, he think he liable to be home soon now.
They drank coffee and sat for a long time, looking into each other's eyes. His cup rattled against his teeth. She poured her coffee into a saucer, and some of it dripped down on her lap.
William,
Dr. Copeland said. As he pronounced the name, his teeth bit deeply into his tongue, and he moved his jaw with pain. They sat for a long while. Portia held his hand. The bleak morning light made the windows gray. Outside, it was still raining.
If I means to get to work, I better go on now, Portia said.
He followed her through the hall and stopped at the hat rack to put on his coat and shawl. The open door let in a gust of wet, cold air. Highboy sat out on the street curb with a wet newspaper over his head for protection. Along the sidewalk, there was a fence. Portia leaned against this as she walked. Dr. Copeland followed a few paces after her, and his hands also touched boards of the fence to steady himself. Highboy trailed behind them. He waited for the black, terrible anger as though for some beast out of the night. But it did not come to him. His bowels seemed weighted with lead, and he walked slowly and lingered against fences and the cold, wet walls of buildings by the way. Descent into the depths until at last there was no further chasm below. He touched the solid bottom of despair, and there took ease. In this, he knew a certain strong and holy gladness, the persecuted laugh, and the black slave sings to his outraged soul beneath the whip. A song was in him now, although it was not music, but only the feeling of a song. And the sodden heaviness of peace weighted down his limbs so that it was only with the strong, true purpose that he moved. Why did he go onward? Why did he not rest here upon the bottom of utmost humiliation and for a while take his content? But he went onward.
Uncle, said Mick, you think some hot coffee would make you feel better?
Dr. Copeland looked into her face but gave no sign that he heard. They had crossed the town and come at last to the alley behind the Kelly's house. Portia had entered first, and then he followed. Highboy remained on the steps outside. Mick and her two little brothers were already in the kitchen. Portia told of William.
Dr. Copeland did not listen to the words, but her voice had a rhythm, a start, a middle, and an end. Then, when she was finished, she began all over. Others came into the room to hear. Dr. Copeland sat on a stool in the corner. His coat and shawl steamed over the back of a chair by the stove. He held his hat on his knees, and his long, dark hands moved nervously around the worn brim. The yellow insides of his hands were so moist that occasionally he wiped them with a handkerchief. His head trembled, and all of his muscles were stiff with the effort to make it be still. Mr. Singer came into the room. Dr. Copeland raised up his face to him.
"Have you heard of this?"
he asked. Mr. Singer nodded. In his eyes, there was no horror or pity or hate. Of all those who knew, his eyes alone did not express these reactions, for he alone understood this thing. Mick whispered to Portia,
"What's your father's name?"
"He named Benedict Maddie Copeland." Mick leaned over close to Dr. Copeland and shouted in his face as though he were deaf.
"Benedict, don't you think some hot coffee would make you feel a little better?"
Dr. Copeland started.
"Quit that hollering," Portia said. "He can hear as well as you can."
"Oh," said Mick.
She emptied the grounds from the pot and put the coffee on the stove to boil again. The mute still lingered in the doorway. Dr. Copeland still looked into his face.
"You heard?"
"What'll they do to those prison guards?" Mick asked.
"Honey, I just don't know," Portia said. "I just don't know. I'd do something. I'd sure do something about it. Nothing us could do would make no difference. Best thing us can do is keep our mouths shut. They ought to be treated just like they did Willie and them. Worse. I wish I could round up some people and kill those men myself." "That ain't no Christian way to talk," Portia said. "Us can just rest back and know they're gonna be chopped up with pitchforks and fired everlasting by Satan. Anyway, Willie can still play his harp. With both feet sawed off, that's about all he can do."
The house was full of noise and unrest. In the room above the kitchen, someone was moving furniture about. The dining room was crowded with boarders. Mrs. Kelly hurried back and forth from the breakfast table to the kitchen. Mr. Kelly wandered about in a baggy pair of trousers and a bathrobe. The young Kelly children ate greedily in the kitchen. Doors banged and voices could be heard in all parts of the house. Mick handed Dr. Copeland a cup of coffee mixed with watery milk. The milk gave the drink a gray-blue sheen. Some of the coffee had sloshed over into the saucer, so first he dried the saucer and the rim of the cup with his handkerchief. He had not wanted coffee at all.
"I wish I could kill them," Mick said.
The house quieted. The people in the dining room went out to work. Mick and George left for school, and the baby was shut into one of the front rooms. Mrs. Kelly wrapped a towel around her head and took a broom with her upstairs. The mute still stood in the doorway. Dr. Copeland gazed up into his face.
"You know of this?"
he asked again. The words did not sound. They choked in his throat, but his eyes asked the question all the same. Then the mute was gone. Dr. Copeland and Portia were alone. He sat for some time on the stool in the corner. At last he rose to go.
"You sit back down, Father. Us going to stay together this morning. I'm going to fry some fish and have egg bread and potatoes for the dinner. You stay on here, and then I means to serve you a good hot meal."
"You know I have calls."
"Let's us just this one day. Please, Father. I feels like I'm going to really bust loose. Besides, I don't want you messing around in the streets by yourself."
He hesitated and felt the collar of his overcoat. It was very damp.
"Daughter, I am sorry. You know I have visits."
Portia held his shawl over the stove until the wool was hot. She buttoned his coat and turned up the collar about his neck. He cleared his throat and spat into one of the squares of paper that he carried with him in his pocket. Then he burned the paper in the stove. On the way out, he stopped and spoke to Highboy on the steps. He suggested that Highboy stay with Portia if he could arrange to get leave from work. The air was piercing and cold. From the low, dark skies, the drizzling rain fell steadily. The rain had seeped into the garbage cans, and in the alley there was the rank odor of wet refuse. As he walked, he balanced himself with the help of a fence and kept his dark eyes on the ground. He made all the strictly necessary visits. Then he attended to office patients from noon until 2 o'clock. Afterward, he sat at his desk with his fists clenched tight. But it was useless to try to cogitate on this thing. He wished never again to see a human face. Yet at the same time, he could not sit alone in the empty room. He put on his overcoat and went out again into the wet, cold street. In his pocket were several prescriptions to be left at the pharmacy. But he did not wish to speak with Marshall Nichols. He went into the store and laid the prescriptions upon the counter. The pharmacist turned from the powders he was measuring and held out both his hands. His thick lips worked soundlessly for a moment before he gained his poise. "Doctor," he said formally, "you must be aware that I and all our colleagues and the members of my lodge and church, we have your sorrow uppermost in our minds and wish to extend to you our deepest sympathy." Dr. Copeland turned shortly and left without a word. That was too little. Something more was needed. The strong, true purpose, the will to justice. He walked stiffly, his arms held close to his sides toward the main street. He cogitated without success. He could think of no white person of power in all the town who was both brave and just. He thought of every lawyer, every judge, every public official with whose name he was familiar, but the thought of each one of these white men was bitter in his heart. At last he decided on the judge of the Superior Court. When he reached the courthouse, he did not hesitate but entered quickly, determined to see the judge that afternoon. The wide front hall was empty, except for a few idlers who lounged in the doorways leading to the offices on either side. He did not know where he could find the judge's office, so he wandered uncertainly through the building, looking at the placards on the doors. At last, he came to a narrow passage. Halfway through this corridor, three white men stood talking together and blocked the way. He drew close to the wall to pass, but one of them turned to stop him.
"What you want? Will you please tell me where the judge's office is located?"
The white man jerked his thumb toward the end of the passage. Dr. Copeland recognized him as a deputy sheriff. They had seen each other dozens of times, but the deputy did not remember him. All white people looked similar to Negroes, but Negroes took care to differentiate between them. On the other hand, all Negroes looked similar to white men, but white men did not usually bother to fix the face of a Negro in their minds, so the white man said,
"What you want, Reverend?"
The familiar joking title nettled him.
"I am not a minister," he said. "I am a physician, a medical doctor. My name is Benedict Matty Copeland, and I wish to see the judge immediately on urgent business."
The deputy was like other white men in that a clearly enunciated speech maddened him.
"Is that so?" he mocked.
He winked at his friends.
"Then I am the deputy sheriff, and my name is Mr. Wilson, and I'll tell you the judge is busy. Come back some other day." "It is imperative that I see the judge," Dr. Copeland said. "I will wait."
There was a bench at the entrance of the passage, and he sat down. The three white men continued to talk, but he knew that the sheriff watched him. He was determined not to leave. More than half an hour passed. Several white men went freely back and forth through the corridor. He knew that the deputy was watching him, and he sat rigid, his hands pressed between his knees. His sense of prudence told him to go away and return later in the afternoon when the sheriff was not there. All of his life he had been circumspect in his dealings with such people, but now something in him would not let him withdraw.
"Come here, you," the deputy said finally.
His head trembled, and when he arose, he was not steady on his feet.
"Yes." "What you say you wanted to see the judge about?"
"I did not say," said Dr. Copeland. "I merely said that my business with him was urgent."
"You can't stand up straight. You've been drinking liquor, haven't you? I smell it on your breath."
"That is a lie," said Dr. Copeland slowly. "I have not." The sheriff struck him on the face. He fell against the wall. Two white men grasped him by the arm and dragged him down the steps to the main floor. He did not resist.
"That's the trouble with this country," the sheriff said. "These damn bigoted niggers like him."
He spoke no word and let them do with him as they would. He waited for the terrible anger and felt it arise in him. Rage made him weak, so that he stumbled. They put him into the wagon with two men as guards. They took him to the station and then to the jail. It was only when they entered the jail that the strength of his rage came to him. He broke loose suddenly from their grasp. In a corner, he was surrounded. They struck him on the head and shoulders with their clubs. A glorious strength was in him, and he heard himself laughing aloud as he fought. He sobbed and laughed at the same time. He kicked wildly with his feet. He fought with his fists and even struck at them with his head. Then he was clutched fast so that he could not move. They dragged him foot by foot through the hall of the jail. The door to a cell was opened. Someone behind kicked him in the groin, and he fell to his knees on the floor. In the cramped cubicle, there were five other prisoners, three Negroes and two white men. One of the white men was very old and drunk. He sat on the floor and scratched himself. The other white prisoner was a boy not more than 15 years of age. The three Negroes were young. As Dr. Copeland lay on the bunk, looking up into their faces, he recognized one of them.
"How come you here?"
the young man asked.
"Ain't you Dr. Copeland?"
He said yes.
"My name's Derek White. You taken out my sister's tonsils last year."
The icy cell was permeated with a rotten odor. A pail brimming with urine was in a corner. Cockroaches crawled upon the walls. He closed his eyes, and immediately he must have slept, for when he looked up again, the small barred window was black, and a bright light burned in the hall. Four empty tin plates were on the floor. His dinner of cabbage and cornbread was beside him. He sat on the bunk and sneezed violently several times. When he breathed, the phlegm rattled in his chest. After a while, the young white boy began to sneeze also. Dr. Copeland ran out of squares of paper, and he had to use sheets from a notebook in his pocket. The white boy leaned over the pail in the corner, or simply let the water run from his nose onto the front of his shirt. His eyes were dilated, his clear cheeks flushed. He huddled on the edge of a bunk and groaned. Soon they were led out to the lavatory, and on their return, they prepared for sleep. There were six men to occupy four bunks. The old man lay snoring on the floor. Derry and another boy squeezed into a bunk together. The hours were long. The light in the hall burned his eyes, and the odor in the cell made every breath a discomfort. He could not keep warm. His teeth chattered, and he shook with a hard chill. He sat up with the dirty blanket wrapped around him and swayed to and fro. Twice he reached over to cover the white boy, who muttered and threw out his arms in sleep. He swayed, his head in his hands, and from his throat there came a singing moan. He could not think of William, nor could he even cogitate upon the strong, true purpose and draw strength from that. He could only feel the misery in him. Then the tide of his fever turned. A warmth spread through him.
He lay back, and it seemed he sank down into a place warm and red and full of comfort. The next morning, the sun came out. The strange southern winter was at its end. Dr. Copeland was released. A little group waited outside the jail for him. Mr. Singer was there. Portia and Highboy and Marshal Nichols were present also. Their faces were confused, and he could not see them clearly. The sun was very bright.
"Father, don't you know that ain't no way to help our Willie? Messing around at a white folks' courthouse? Best thing us can do is keep our mouth shut and wait."
Her loud voice echoed wearily in his ears. They climbed into a 10-cent taxicab, and then he was home, and his face pressed into the fresh white pillow. 11. Mick could not sleep all night. Etta was sick, so she had to sleep in the living room. The sofa was too narrow and short. She had nightmares about Willie. Nearly a month had gone by since Portia had told about what they had done to him, but still she couldn't forget it. Twice in the night, she had these bad dreams and woke up on the floor. A bump came out on her forehead. Then at 6 o'clock, she heard Bill go to the kitchen and fix his breakfast. It was daylight, but the shades were down so that the room was half dark. She felt queer waking up in the living room. She didn't like it. The sheet was twisted around her, half on the sofa and half on the floor. The pillow was in the middle of the room. She got up and opened the door to the hall. Nobody was on the stairs. She ran in her nightgown to the back room.
"Move over, George."
The kid lay in the very center of the bed. The night had been warm, and he was naked as a jaybird. His fists were shut tight, and even in sleep, his eyes were squinted like he was thinking about something very hard to figure out. His mouth was open, and there was a little wet spot on the pillow. She pushed him.
"Wait," he said in his sleep. "Move over on your side." "Wait. Let me just finish this here dream, this here."
She hauled him over where he belonged and lay down close to him. When she opened her eyes again, it was late, because the sun shone in through the back window. George was gone. From the yard, she heard kids' voices and the sound of water running. Etta and Hazel were talking in the middle room. As she dressed, a sudden notion came to her. She listened at the door, but it was hard to hear what they said. She jerked the door open quick to surprise them. They were reading a movie magazine. Etta was still in bed. She had her hand halfway over the picture of an actor.
"From here up, don't you think he favors that boy who used to date with..."
"How you feel this morning, Etta?" Mick asked. She looked down under the bed, and her private box was still in the exact place where she had left it.
"A lot you care," Etta said. "You needn't try to pick a fight."
Etta's face was peaked. There was a terrible pain in her stomach, and her ovary was diseased. It had something to do with being unwell. The doctor said they would have to cut out her ovary right away, but their dad said they would have to wait. There wasn't any money.
"How do you expect me to act anyway?" Mick said. "I ask you a polite question, and then you start to nag at me. I feel like I ought to be sorry for you because you're sick, but you won't let me be decent. Therefore, I naturally get mad."
She pushed back the bangs of her hair and looked close into the mirror.
"Boy, see this bump I got? But my head's broke. Twice I fell out last night, and it seemed to me like I hit that table by the sofa. I can't sleep in the living room. That sofa cramps me so much I can't stay in it." "Hush that talking so loud," Hazel said.
Mick knelt down on the floor and pulled out the big box. She looked carefully at the string that was tied around it.
"Say, have either of you fooled with this?"
"Shoot," Etta said. "What would we want to mess with your junk for?"
"You just better not. I kill anybody that tried to mess with my private things."
"Listen to that," Hazel said. "Mick Kelly, I think you're the most selfish person I've ever known. You don't care a thing in the world about anybody but..."
"Ah, poot!"
She slammed the door. She hated both of them. That was a terrible thing to think, but it was true. Her dad was in the kitchen with Portia. He had on his bathrobe and was drinking a cup of coffee. The whites of his eyes were red, and his cup rattled against the saucer. He walked round and round the kitchen table.
What time is it? Has Mr. Singer gone yet?
He been gone, hon, Portia said. It near about 10 o'clock.
10 o'clock? Golly, I never have slept that late before. What you keep in that big hat box you tote around with you?
Mick reached into the stove and brought out half a dozen biscuits.
Ask me no questions and I'll tell you no lies. A bad end comes to a person who pries.
If there's a little extra milk, I think I'll just have it poured over some crumbled bread, her dad said. Graveyard soup. Maybe that'll help settle my stomach.
Mick split open the biscuits and put slices of fried white meat inside them. She sat down on the back steps to eat her breakfast. The morning was warm and bright. Spare Ribs and Sucker were playing with George in the backyard. Sucker wore his sun suit, and the other two kids had taken off all their clothes except their shorts. They were scooting each other with the hose. The stream of water sparkled bright in the sun. The wind blew out sprays of it like mist, and in this mist there were the colors of the rainbow. A line of clothes flapped in the wind, white sheets, Ralph's blue dress, a red blouse, and nightgowns, wet and fresh, and blowing out in different shapes. The day was almost like summertime. Fuzzy little yellow jackets buzzed around the honeysuckle on the alley fence.
Watch me hold it up over my head, George hollered. Watch how the water runs down.
She was too full of energy to sit still. George had filled a meal sack with dirt and hung it to a limb of the tree for a punching bag. She began to hit this. Puck, puck. She hit it in time to the song that had been in her mind when she woke up. George had mixed a sharp rock in the dirt, and it bruised her knuckles.
Ow! You skeeted the water right in my ear, busted my eardrum. I can't even hear. Gimme here, let me skeet some.
Sprays of the water blew into her face, and once the kids turned the hose on her legs, she was afraid her box would get wet, so she carried it with her through the alley to the front porch. Harry was sitting on his steps reading the newspaper. She opened her box and got out the notebook, but it was hard to settle her mind on the song she wanted to write down. Harry was looking over in her direction, and she could not think. She and Harry had talked about so many things lately. Nearly every day they walked home from school together. They talked about God. Sometimes she would wake up in the night and shiver over what they had said. Harry was a pantheist. That was a religion, the same as Baptist or Catholic or Jew. Harry believed that after you were dead and buried, you changed to plants and fire and dirt and clouds and water. It took thousands of years, and then finally you were a part of all the world. He said he thought that was better than being one single angel. Anyhow, it was better than nothing. Harry threw the newspaper into his hall and then came over.
It's hot like summer, he said, and only March.
Yeah, I wish we could go swimming.
We would if there was any place.
There's not any place, except that country club pool.
I sure would like to do something. To get out and go somewhere.
Me too, she said. Wait, I know one place. It's out in the country about 15 miles. It's a deep, wide creek in the woods. The Girl Scouts have a camp there in the summertime. Mrs. Wells took me and George and Pete and Sucker swimming there one time last year.
If you want to, I can get bicycles and we can go tomorrow. I have a holiday one Sunday a month.
We'll ride out and take a picnic dinner, Mick said.
Okay, I'll borrow the bikes.
It was time for him to go to work. She watched him walk down the street. He swung his arms. Halfway down the block, there was a bay tree with low branches. Harry took a running jump, caught a limb, and chinned himself. A happy feeling came in her because it was true. They were real good friends. Also, he was handsome. Tomorrow she would borrow Hazel's blue necklace and wear the silk dress. And for dinner they would take jelly sandwiches and niha. Maybe Harry would bring something queer because they ate Orthodox Jew. She watched him until he turned the corner. It was true that he had grown to be a very good-looking fellow.